time from Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
Hi, I'm Jenna, your biochemist.
Welcome back, Jenna.
Thanks.
You were away last week.
Back from the sunny Okanagan.
Have you been productive this week?
I have been productive this week. I am feverishly writing my thesis, which is not quite as quick a process as you might think.
No.
No.
I never really thought that, actually.
but that's just me. But speaking of feverish, it's kind of hot on the prairies. Is there any reason why someplace in the prairies, I don't know, Manitoba-ish, that might be really excited about something new that's coming to the airwaves?
Well, I think there is, because the Radio Freethinker media empire has expanded once more, this time in Winnipeg, Manitoba. That's right, Radio Freethinker can now be heard on CJUM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Mondays at 8 a.m., which is very exciting.
Yeah, I don't like mornings. Do I have to get up at 8 a.m. to do the show? Can we just, like, record it earlier?
Well, they're going to air the show that we're doing right now, Mondays at 8 a.m.
Oh, so I don't have to get up early in the morning. Oh, that's a relief.
That's right. So we're talking to them from the past because they're airing it on Mondays. So yes, it's going to be interesting. And CJUM has a long history providing campus community radio in Winnipeg. They broadcast out of the University of Winnipeg, and the station began in 1975. They closed down due to financial difficulties in the 1980s, but however, they were resurrected by some enterprising students there and got a license from the CRTC in 97, and they started broadcasting in 98. So we're very honored and happy to be included on their lineup. And you know what? I found out that CJUM seems to be a pretty skeptic-friendly place. I looked at their schedule, and I noticed how Radio Free Thinker follows another skeptical show, our comrades over at Skeptically Speaking. So they have a block of rational radio Monday mornings. So it's very exciting.
I love being rational.
Rational is fun.
Yes, yes, we like rational. Of course, sometimes rationality fails. Recently, I was doing some looking around, and I found out that apparently public funding of religious schools can be very ecumenical. What do I mean with this? Well, apparently a number of Muslim students are going to Catholic schools in Ontario so as to ensure safe conservative/religious environment. Muslim parents are grateful that in Catholic schools, their children will be taught a conservative approach to things like reproductive biology, sex education, and same-sex relations. That they will be taught the, quote, controversy around the theory of evolution type stuff.
So, wait. These people are happy that it's a conservative religious environment, even if it's not their own religion?
Exactly. Actually, the Catholic schools like it on their part. Not because they're hoping to convert a few people, although that may fall through their, you know, their minds every now and then. But these are publicly funded schools. And so for every student they get in there, the government gives them a whole bunch of cash to teach them. It's estimated now that over 10% of those attending Catholic schools are non-Catholic. Now, because these religions sort of have a shared Abrahamic tradition, i.e. they all sort of come from the Jews originally, then Christians, they're all part of the same sort of deal. These schools tend to emphasize, you know, things like modest dress that makes students feel quite comfortable. Over the past decade, there's anecdotal evidence that Muslims have been more likely to take advantage of the fact that these schools, these Catholic schools, are open to any family who wishes to register, whatever their religion, at least in the secondary level. A number of Islamic students actually come from new immigrant families from Africa, where, quote-unquote, the best schools were the ones run by nuns. This perception also gets migrated, as they believe that the Catholic schools here must also be better, although studies show there's no correlation.
That's interesting because you know, Catholic schools are, I guess, happy to have students of different faiths. But as soon as they have a teacher of a different faith, then they sort of run into troubles. Especially
or
if that,
a teacher of no faith.
Or a teacher who claims to be Catholic but is also a homosexual.
Well, see, again, this is from the Catholic's point of view, they make money on these students. So, you know, as the number of Catholics start to dwindle, they want to maintain a certain revenue so they can support this structure. I mean, one of the classic things of Jesuit philosophy is give me a child to he's seven and I have him for life, right? And it's ironic, too, that in one way, you know, these religious Muslim-type students are being pushed in a certain way into the Catholic public system because there's been a lot of pushback in secular schools where the success of atheist and non-secular movements have actually pushed back on religious practice that happen in school. So things like prayer and all that, right? You know, that's no longer seen appropriate in secular schools. And when we, as good atheists, complain about this, that creates a pressure for those who are still religiously minded to get away. I mean, for example, if you're a devout Muslim, you must pray five times a day, and to do that in a public school is just impossible.
I'm wondering, too, if occasionally some of these decisions don't actually have much to do with the religious or conservative feelings in the school, but actually do have some kind of academic basis. So for myself, I grew up in a town where we had one choice of school, which recently burned to the ground, giving them a grand total of zero choices of school. But
remind me again, where were you?
In Oliver, BC. South Okanagan Secondary is gone. But I know that, you know, students, their parents in the city and whatnot, where they do have more choices as to where they might be able to send their kids, can weigh those choices carefully as far as, you know, maybe although the biology department might not be fantastic, there's nothing saying that a Catholic teacher can't teach really good physics or something like that. So, I mean, not that I think that would be the majority of cases, but I'm sure that would come into it in some parents' decisions to send their children to a publicly funded and open Catholic school as opposed to another local school that might not have a good reputation in a department they care about.
As you pointed, as I sort of mentioned and you're pointing out, there is actually a much stronger perception that these schools have better academic records than they actually weighs up. If you look at Catholic schools, and let's take them as a private school just for the sake of this argument, compared to other private schools that are not Catholic-based, they show no significant difference as far as their performance rates. And when you compare them on aggregate to the public school, again, there's no noticeable change. Now, there will be some exceptions because there are some schools that are just...
Well, and department to department variation. I mean, I can definitely see some Catholic schools having an excellent music program, for example,
and
where the public schools might not have.
It's probably quite good, too.
But, you know, this does bring up some interesting potential issues that we might see in the future. We heard about that there were Catholic schools in Ontario that were not allowing gay, lesbian student groups. What if some of these Muslim students decided to start a Muslim student association? Is that going to be allowed? Is that going to be tolerated? And if that's tolerated, could they start a atheist student group in a Catholic school?
Well, again, I think one of the things that makes this sort of a neat fit is I don't think any Muslim student would be going to one of these Catholic schools. It seems like one of the main criteria is you must be sort of a conservative Muslim thing. And in which case, even though your actual religious practices may slightly differ and your God is of a slightly different name, by and large, most of the things you actually live day to day are lockstep. I mean, social conservatives, irrespective of the actual belief system, you know, they don't think kids should be having sex. They don't think they should be even taught that sex exists until they're 21.
So maybe what we really need is not actually Catholic schools, but schools that recapitulate the 50s.
Exactly. No, and in a way, you've hit it right on the button there. And I think the only thing I have a big issue with this, I mean, obviously, I think education is a right that all students should have, and they shouldn't be allowed to be deprived that just because it's a Catholic school. So, I mean, they talk about things like evolution, for example, or reproductive, the way the body works. They're sort of denied that form of education. And I'm not sure I think anyone should be denied that. But where the real crux of this goes is that these are publicly funded schools. And these are publicly funded schools that are providing an overtly religious message. and oddly enough, a overtly conservative message, because again, the religious part of this gets a little fuzzy when you start getting this sort of...
So when you say conservative, do you mean politically conservative or theologically conservative?
I guess I'm going to say socially conservative.
So okay.
I'm splitting the hairs there. Because obviously, if this was a fundamentalist Catholic church,
right.
School, they wouldn't be any more happier with Muslims than...
Well, yeah, that's what I'm thinking,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And, I mean, politics can play into this, but I don't think this is the main thing. Again, I think it's the conservative lifestyle that they're after.
Right.
Well, and I might be wrong here, but given that they are publicly funded, I think the schools don't have a choice on what students they're allowed to admit. Is that correct?
That is not correct.
Oh.
These Catholic schools are allowed to have attend whomever they say qualifies. Now, normally...
Is that allowed to be on religious basis, though?
Yes. And that's why they've lowered their standards, so to speak, in secondary school, because again, dwindling numbers means they want bodies in seats to keep the doors open. But they still, from what I understand and from my research has, and I'm always welcome for new information if anyone wants to correct this by sending us their email to info@radiofreethinker.com. But from what I understand, in elementary and that, it's still very strictly you must be a Catholic in order to go.
Hmm.
That's interesting.
Yes.
Well, why don't we shift gears a little bit, Don?
Well, hold on. Let me grab my coffee here. Ah, it's good. I like the little pick-me-up I get from my coffee. But, okay. So, this segment...
Don's in denial. Deep, deep coffee denial.
This segment is actually titled The Coffee Illusion. Apparently, there's a misconception that coffee stimulates you. However, the truth is that you become addicted to caffeine quickly, and soon you're drinking coffee to cure withdrawal more than you are for the stimulant effect. Actually, I remember listening to a science podcast a few months ago that was actually specifically on this one whole topic about how caffeine isn't so much of a stimulant to most people who use it, but actually just mediates existing withdrawal symptoms, and that sort of mimics the idea that it's providing a stimulative effect. Now, it is true when you first try coffee, there are some stimulative effects that occur.
Or when you don't drink coffee that often, then drink it at night.
Yes. Well, but apparently our body quickly develops tolerance to this. How quickly, you may ask. Studies have gone, and apparently complete tolerance to the sleep disruption effect, i.e. you're able to stay awake and you don't fall asleep, of caffeine, can develop after consuming 400 milligrams of caffeine 3 times a day for 7 days. Complete tolerance of the subjective effects of caffeine, again that, ooh, I feel a bit of a perk, was observed to develop after consuming 300 milligrams 3 times a day for 18 days. Or to put it in common terms that you and I would understand, roughly 3 or 4 large coffees at your local beanery. Because caffeine is primarily an antagonist to the central nervous... Okay, Jenna, what's an antagonist?
Well, you have to be an antagonist to something. So this is an antagonist for the neurotransmitter adenosine. So basically, the way that our brain, our neurons communicate with each other, they release these neurotransmitters that are little molecules released from one cell that are taken up to the next cell. So what caffeine is doing in this instance is... going to the receptors for these molecules, so how the receiving neuron is able to receive the signal and blocking those. So it's acting sort of against the action of this neurotransmitter so that it can't complete the message.
So, and then in caffeine's case, the way our body compensates for this interruption is to create more receptors for adrenaline itself.
Exactly. So when the caffeine is bound to the receptor, then it's not, again, not able to complete that message, not able to do its job. So the body compensates by producing a whole bunch more of the receptors. So you have a bunch of ones that are clogged with caffeine and then a bunch of them that are functional. So when the caffeine gets removed, you have way more of the functional ones than you're used to.
So first thing that happens, of course, when you create these new receptors, is the stimulatory effect of caffeine is substantially reduced.
Exactly. So this is called physiological tolerance. So this is where our bodies have actually physically done something so that we can tolerate the presence of the caffeine. So in this case, again, we have the clogged receptors, so our body's not really tolerating that. So we produce all these extra receptors. So then if you sort of zoom out, the effect is basically the same as if there was no caffeine at all.
And then, of course, when this essentially creates sort of a false sensitivity to adrenosine. And so when you reduce your coffee intake, effectively you're increasing the normal effects that adrenosine would have.
Exactly.
Resulting in the unwelcome side effects. So one of the side effects of caffeine is to dilate or shrink the blood vessels in the head. When you stop drinking coffee, these vessels expand, causing a quote-unquote excess of blood, resulting in headaches and nausea, which is why anyone who's gone through coffee withdrawal knows that a headache is one of the symptoms. Now, I guess on the upside is these side effects will also diminish after a short period of time, months, weeks, sort of thing. But the whole point of this article is that, you know, people say, oh, I'm not myself until I have my morning coffee. Well, it's not that the morning coffee gives you a big pickup in the morning. It's that your body has been suffering a diminishment of the caffeine while you were asleep, and you're starting to get the withdrawal symptoms, so that when you have that first cup of coffee, you're actually kind of returning yourself to normal, and that the supposed stimulant effect of caffeine isn't really there.
Yeah, and I think it's important to realize that there is a real physical basis for that. This is not mental withdrawal, this is physiological withdrawal. Like, you can have withdrawal from a particular TV show program that may no longer be in existence, but that's not a physical withdrawal. Here we have changed the physiology of our brains to be able to accommodate caffeine, and when that's taken away, then you have a physical withdrawal symptoms.
I was surprised, again, at one, how little coffee it takes and how quickly this tolerance builds up. I mean, if you're the kind of person who has one cup a day, will this affect, do you think, will they develop a tolerance to that as well?
I kind of feel that one cup might not, or like a lower level, but it really, I mean, I think it would have to be tested. I assume that various levels have been tested, and that's why the levels that you were quoting earlier about, you know, three coffees a day for 7 days or whatever is probably some kind of threshold where you're able to notice a physiological effect, but that's sort of conjecture on my part.
Well, I say we all get a coffee and we start testing this right away.
Sounds great.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Don, for that. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker. When we come back, we will have the return of Radio Freethinker Argument Clinic and more after this.
We like to party, right? Guys like him, they don't like to party like we do. You know, we're having a lot of fun.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We like to party.
Yeah, we like to party. Did I say that already?
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
Here on Radio Freethinker, we often talk about things called logical fallacies in terms of argument rhetoric. But if you're not an expert with these terms, this segment is for you. This is Radio Freethinker Argument Clinic.
Yes, it is. An argument is a collective series of statements to establish a definite proposition.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Argument Clinic. This time, we're not going to talk about a specific kind of argument, but rather a definition of terms. We're going to think about things like theism, deism, atheism, agnosticism, what these things actually mean and how it differs from the way the public thinks about them. The theist is someone who believes in a deity or believes in a theology. So basically, someone who is religious and believes in a god is a theist. A deist is an interesting case. They think that there is a god or some kind of deity, but that if such a deity existed, all they did was set the universe into motion and then fobbed off to do something else. watch TV, perhaps. But they believe that there is a deity, but that they don't intercede or affect the world, or, you know, they don't do anything to anyone in any way. Agnostic, I mean, one way of thinking about it is someone who is sitting on the fence. They haven't decided. They're not really sure. Maybe God exists, maybe God doesn't. Who are we to say? But a more hardline definition from a philosophical perspective of an agnostic is when you look at the term agnostic, not knowing. So technically, agnosticism can be applied to any metaphysical claim about the existence or non-existence of some entity. So an agnostic of religion, or of deities in specific, thinks that there is no logical or reasonable way of deciding whether or not the God exists. It's not even the sort of way that most people who think about agnosticism in a colloquial way believe that, well, there could be a God, or there's possibly a God. It's not even that. There's no claims about the probabilities at all. There's no logical argument by which you can decide the likelihood of the existence of God or not. Let's start from the sort of dictionary definition of atheist. Again, a theist, no theology or no religion. Someone who doesn't believe in deities is an atheist, and that's it. So at this level, almost everyone is an atheist about something. As Richard Dawkins enjoys pointing out, most people, even if they're Christians, are atheists about Thor or about the Flying Spaghetti Monster. So at that level, atheism is a fairly basic position of, okay, I don't believe in deities, which in some senses means that agnosticism and atheism aren't actually mutually incompatible, as a lot of people think about it, that you can be an agnostic atheist and, you know, there's no logical way of deciding whether or not God exists, but I'm going to decide that God doesn't exist based on, and this is another kind of atheist, the evidence. So a scientific evidence-based atheism goes from, okay, well, if a God would exist, what kind of things would we expect in the world? Observable evidence. And you look at that observable evidence and decide, okay, well, this doesn't seem to fit with the theory that there is indeed a deity. Therefore, I'm going to assume, with a fairly high probability of being correct, that there is no God. The new atheism, the four horsemen like Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, they are typically portrayed in the media as not just hardline atheists, as in there are definitely no gods, but also very critical of religion. Religion leads to all the ills in the world and should be eradicated as soon as possible for the safety of the citizens of this planet. But when you really think about it, I mean, the idea that religion is a bad thing has always been sort of connected to the idea of atheism, because most people don't really become atheists when they just think about the evidence. It's because they've had a falling out, as it were, with religion in some way. That there's some, you know, a lot of atheists were actually raised religious, and then they didn't like the way the church was telling them to do things, and then they looked at the evidence, and then, you know, you start questioning it because of something else. So the idea that the new atheists are the very first people to popularize the idea that you could be atheist and you should also be hardline critical of religion, that's hardly a new idea.
This was Radio Free Thinker, Argument Clinic.
Now, let's get one thing quite clear. I most definitely told you.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And we're back with Radio Free Thinker. So I think I've learned that, you know, it can be sometimes difficult to communicate when you come from different backgrounds and different belief systems. So I want to check, can you guys understand me? So
your lips are moving, but I can't hear what you're saying.
Have you been catching anything up and I've been saying today?
Don, who is that person?
Okay. So I have there seems to be a gap in our communication.
Yeah, well, I have a confession. I know, you know, you might not have guessed it based on my use of a beaker to drink my morning coffee, but I'm a scientist. And I felt that I had to come out about that. Maybe, you know, that'll help us to see eye to eye, so to speak.
We could tell the pointy head.
I know. I try and hide. I wear lots of hats, but you know, we're not actually that visibly recognizable as a minority. And I know that you think that more people out there might be scientists, but in fact, I've learned that most people on the street, not scientists. And you might be surprised to know that most of the time, we talk just like everybody else. And that's unless we have really awesome fuzzy hair, it can be really hard to spot us. Unless we start talking to each other about our work. And then it can get pretty sticky. And it can be pretty easy to recognize a scientist because you might not be able to actually understand them. Unfortunately, this also includes a lot of the time when scientists are talking to the press. So what's with that anyway? I don't know if you guys have noticed, but there is a major gap in scientific communication, I think. And what exactly gets lost in translation? And more importantly, do we have the tools to fill this gap in scientific communication in our society? What do you think?
No, we don't. Unless you can tell us differently.
No, I don't think. Well, I mean, it's going to take a lot of work. But let's talk about some of the issues in science communication, because I know that there's a lot of science that's being reported in the news. And I think, I mean, I have a slightly biased point of view being the age that I am. But I think that science communication in the media is increasing, and especially with sort of more topical sort of science related shows in general has sort of spurred an increase in scientific stories in the general media.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it is a good thing, but I think that there are some problems. So first off, let's sort of talk about the differences, the fundamental differences between scientific communication in quotes and public communication. And there's something we've discussed before. There's a BC government scientist, Christy Miller, that was recently in the news for allegedly being muzzled by the government. So allegations in the press outlined that she was being prevented from publicly sharing her scientific findings because they were against the interests of current government policymaking. So the scientist herself was unable to contribute to the discussions in the media around her until very recently. So according to her, there was no muzzle involved. But she couldn't talk to the press, and information couldn't get out there. Not according to her. So she had asserted that she had not been prevented from publishing her work in a scientific journal and had been asked not to speak at public press conferences to reserve her comments for the Cohen Commission, which is a public and official channel to investigate practices and consequences associated with salmon farming. So the bottom line is the information from both of these channels was publicly available. That's both the Cohen Commission and the scientific publication that she did publish. Without censure. And so these channels are available for the public, but they're not available for the same sort types of, you know, I sort of understand it, interpretation and sensationalization that science so often suffers on the evening news. So this situation where scientists only feel comfortable sharing their results or the results of their employees in highly official channels is obviously not ideal. And this is where most people feel comfortable, because these types of official channels are not where most people feel comfortable getting their information. So the scientists sharing their information feel comfortable in one area, but the general public consuming that information feel comfortable in another area of the media, meaning that these don't necessarily meet up. So this is a situation, however, I think is highly symptomatic of today's topic of the scientific information gap, where the audience and the people sharing their information are really not connecting on the same level.
I don't know, the one thing I can think of, and I don't think this is a minor issue, and this is going to maybe go a little left from your argument, but politicians are not elected, or at least solely, by scientists. So, I mean, we must have some attempt to have sort of sound science reporting news in the popular press. It sounds almost like you're thinking that there's this big divide, and that in some ways, well, so for example, this particular person who was quote unquote muzzled, it seems like she wasn't muzzled because she was allowed to publish her results in the quote unquote official channels.
Well, and I think more to the point is she didn't feel like she was being censored. It was more other people making accusations about her being censored.
So Now, from what I understand, she was asked not to talk to the public press, the popular press,
yep.
about this, right?
Yeah, until the commission had run its course.
Right. So whether or not she had wanted to or not, she was still muzzled. I mean, the fact that I don't want to leave this room doesn't change the fact that someone might have locked the door, right? I am still sort of locked in this room. So although I can appreciate that she may not have felt comfortable being able to go out to the popular press and wouldn't have done so even if she had been allowed to, the fact that she wasn't allowed to is the crux of the issue here. And that if we limit scientists' ability to make public their information only through official channels, which I admit are public, but as you said yourself, the journals, the scientific journals, having read through more than I probably care to, are not exactly light reading that the average consumer can understand.
They're not easily digestible by a general audience. And I think that more the point of what we're going to discuss today is not the fact that this happened, because clearly, yes, there was censorship on some level. There was. I guess the question might be censorship of who and why? Because it was not censorship of the results themselves, because those were available. There was a censorship of the way that it was presented to people. And the question that I think forms the crux of the problem that we're seeing and some of the major issues as far as this gap occurring is why people feel the need to put those censures in place.
I mean, most scientists know that climate change is real and that radical and immediate action needs to be taken. I mean, that's kind of a 98%
it's a scientific consensus.
Right. But at the same time, the public, and most especially politicians, seem willfully ignorant of this fact, in spite of the facts that scientists have tried to go out of their way to popularize this. And I don't see how limiting their ability to do this will cure the problem.
Well, and I think one of the, and as we'll talk about a little bit later, this mistrust of scientific consensus is one of the major consequences of the problem in science, sort of science reporting on one side, well, on both sides, right? So reporting by the scientists themselves and reporting of scientists' science by the press. Some of the problems that are occurring in that arena can result in this type of mistrust of science and scientific consensus by the public. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. So as far as being only able to say things in public channels, obviously some people might cry that this reeks of elitism on the scientists' part, or on those that are regulating them. So not being able to share the information with people already connected to the scientific community. It's surely is better to ask the general media to disseminate scientific information to a broader audience so that everyone has this information available to them. So in a world of no misunderstandings and, you know, without the need for eye-catching headlines, which we'll also discuss, I would completely agree with this, that really the best way to get information is the way that the majority of the public is going to be able to access this information, for one, and understand it. However, this is sort of not the problem that's happening right now. In our world, sometimes a little knowledge can be a really dangerous thing, and the mainstream media has a habit of reinterpreting scientific data to fit the story of the day. So I'd like to stress that it is not done most of the time with any nefarious intent whatsoever, and probably often without even the knowledge of the reporter who's twisting the data and really banging it and bruising it and beating it over the head and murdering it. But what I'm really trying to say is that overinterpretation of data is very, very, very easy, and so is slightly misinterpreting data. Scientists get this wrong too, but are constantly being reminded to only draw conclusions supported by the data. But reporters and editors without a scientific background don't have this kind of constant reinforcement to stay within the bounds of what the data say, and have myriad factors stacked against them for saying that, you know, making it a good story, making it a sensational story, and making it fit with what's going on in the news that day.
And I understand where you're going with this, but, you know, that does sound very elitist in the way you're saying it, that reporters, they're just not smart enough to understand the stories, and only us scientists can really know what we're trying to say, which I don't think is what you really meant, but
no.
In a way, maybe it is.
I don't think it's so much not smart enough, but there you can't be trained in everything. This is why we have different vocations in our society. Scientists are trained to be scientists, and reporters and editors are trained to be reporters and editors. And sometimes the skill sets that are required are not necessarily overlapping, or they aren't right now in the media, or the proper attention is not being paid by certain people in the media or in science about certain communication skills and necessities that are going to enable the public to get an accurate idea of the science that's being produced.
So, but again, I'm going to jump ahead and you'll swap me down, I'm sure, for this. So what you're saying is that the journalists don't have the right skill set to do good research, good science stories, but that somehow the scientists will have good enough journalistic abilities in order to get their studies out.
Absolutely not. So I am not trying to put, I'm not trying to replace journalists with scientists in science reporting. And as I mentioned, the scientist skill set doesn't necessarily overlap with the journalistic skill set, and there are definite communication skill sort of deficiencies in the scientific community that are contributing to the gap. It's absolutely on both sides. But as things are right now, I think that members of the media, between problems in skill set in understanding scientific concepts, and it doesn't have to do with intelligence so much as training, and problems as far as motivations with trying to sell papers that are not selling, and basically trying to get the media attention that they need to continue running their industry. The motivations and skill sets are such that there is a lot of bad science reporting happening. So maybe we will go to a commercial break and come back and talk about another story that sort of illustrates this concept.
I'm this guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star. The planet is just another speck. To think about all of this, to think about the vast.
Radio Free Thinker is heard Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned. We're all connected.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
So, to illustrate the point about, you know, what can happen as far as miscommunications between science or reinterpretation in the media, let's look at the case where the press really got it wrong. So, as many of you know, in London, England, it was recently rocked by a series of riots during which extensive, and I mean really extensive, damage was done to businesses and other property in the city. So, as we experienced after our own hockey-precipitated riot here in Vancouver, people start looking for why after an occurrence like this. So thanks to some on-the-fly journalistic interpretation of some of the recent science, many publications in Britain and indeed apparently around the world found and reported a potential why purportedly backed up by some solid science. So that sounds pretty good that we were able to find some scientific evidence. The problem? The scientists that did this science don't agree with this at all.
You mean they're arguing against their own paper?
No, they're arguing against the journalistic reinterpretation, and fairly creative, as we'll see, of their paper. So the actual paper, which was produced by a group of scientists at Cardiff University, established a correlation, and again, read correlation, not causation, between the neurotransmitter GABA, or G-A-B-A, and a certain type of impulsive personality. So basically, they found that people who exhibited more rash impulsivity also had lower levels of GABA in their frontal lobes. So I should mention, they did not look at riots in any capacity. So after this interesting finding, the scientists wrote up their paper, and as was encouraged by their university, they issued a press release. So this is sort of a short article detailing some of the major findings that's released, as the title might suggest, to the press. So this is where things went pretty far south. So before long, the press was reporting stories with titles like, quote, brain chemical lack spurs rioting. And the spurs rioting part was in quotes. So that's insinuating that that part of the title actually came from the scientific paper. Again, the paper had nothing about rioting.
But it could have been with rioting, though. I mean, it didn't say it wasn't with rioting.
The paper?
Right.
No, it did not say that that could not have an effect on rioting, but to put spurs rioting in quotes in the title of a newspaper article about a scientific finding seriously has some implications. So further, some members of the press actually invented a nasal spray that they thought could maybe replace this GABA deficiency and therefore cure rioting. And so they reported that a nasal spray could be developed within the next few years to cure rioting based on the fact that the rioting was clearly caused by a GABA deficiency in the frontal lobe, quoting this research.
Wow, if only they had it during the French Revolution.
If only.
Yeah.
Did they have for nasal sprays?
I don't know. Probably not.
Yeah, snuff.
Mostly fingers up the nose.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, this type of, you know, creative writing obviously constitutes a major misappropriation, misinterpretation, misimagination, misreportation of the scientific data. Basically, horrible translation from the science to the public, leading to a sensational and false idea of the research that got reported all over the world. I also have some personal experience in this area, obviously much less dramatic. I was once interviewed for some research that I was presenting at a scientific conference. So I gave the interview, I stated what we'd found, made it interesting, but definitely within the bounds of what the data was telling us, and sort of gave an idea of its general relevance to the idea or the area of tuberculosis research. And I really made no claims about any sort of cure for TB that I was working on. However, I stayed up to watch the evening news, and there was much different ideas presented there than I had presented in my interview, and it painted me as the TB curing researcher, which I certainly am not.
Okay, wait. So what you're saying is that out of the hundreds of thousands of scientific stories written each week, none of them have any link to reality? Is that what you're trying to say? I mean, your problem isn't with the scientists speaking out, but it's with the entire journalistic institution itself, or so it seems. Even if one accepts a straw man, I don't think the cure to this problem is to isolate the scientists to official channels. Let's go back to where this all began, with the quote-unquote muzzling of a scientist who couldn't go and report to the public, but was only allowed to do so through public but official channels. And I don't see where this is going.
So, firstly, I don't really remember saying that none of this had any link to reality. I think it comes back to what I was saying before about a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of understanding on a topic being really dangerous, because what you're able to do then is draw your own correlations and things that do not stand up to scientific scrutiny. And I agree that limiting things to official channels is really not the way to go if we want to create public awareness of scientific policy. If we do not care if the public understands any scientific research that's going on, that is the most effective way. But that, I think, is not how most people feel. I think that most people would care about fostering a general scientific literacy in the general public. And so these two stories sort of contrast each other in that You know, in one, the scientists are speaking out saying, what the hell? You know, we wanted to report this properly, and this is what came out of it, is this sensational garbage. And on the other hand, we have a scientist saying, well, yeah, you know, I wasn't supposed to talk to the press, but the information still got out there, and it's accurate. So I can see our government saying, you know, of course, we didn't want her to speak, because look at this London example, look at what can happen. So I think that we can all probably agree that there is a problem. And I'm not saying that all of the science reporting that's happening is like this, but given the sort of restraints on trying to get an audience, the news has some major motivations to make things more, quote, interesting or sensational than they actually are. So there definitely is some issue. So the Guardian article... there was a Guardian article recently titled Riot Control, How Can We Stop Newspapers Distorting Scientists? Science. And this was written by some of the scientists involved in this research revolving around the London riots. And they were trying to express their concerns about what had happened, and they asked some pretty important questions in my mind. So firstly, why does the public lap up research like this? And by which I assume they mean research linking chemicals and behavior. And why is it so readily misunderstood? The second question they asked was, how much damage is really done when science is distorted in the press? And the third, what can we do as a community, including both scientific professionals and members of the press, to prevent this type of information and misinformation spread from happening? So before discussing some of their views and mine on the answers to some of these questions, I'd like to point out the fact that these are the specific questions that are being asked is really indicative of the fear of the popular press in the scientific community. Again, you know, they're asking sort of what kind of damage is done when this happens and what can we do to prevent it. And so this fear, many, including myself, would argue is well warranted in the current journalistic climate, and again, general climate of scientific communication, including scientists, as evidenced by stories like this one. So the first question posed in the article about why people are so interested in and so bad at understanding this type of research, lots of speculation can be made, which I'm sure Freud would really go to town on. So this type of research is about how we humans, how we tick. I don't think it's much of a surprise to anyone that humans like to learn about ourselves. And, you know, I think there's something about an ego in there. Anyhow, research linking brain chemicals to behavior seems to be especially intriguing to people, as when misinterpreted, it seems to provide many of the same excuses as the idea of fate. So we are not responsible for our actions. The chemicals made me do it. You know, it's not my fault. It's chemicals. Problematically, chemicals make us, they really make us up, and so are also the consequences of everything we do. So our bodies are bags of chemistry, and to a brain chemical scientist, separating the self from the chemicals is a lot harder than for a lot of the public, who may be more prone to see the self influenced as chemicals rather than the chemicals being completely integrated into the biological and mental and arguably spiritual self.
Well, you know, I think that's an interesting and valid way of looking at things. But for me, I think this is an instance of just a general lack of scientific literacy in the public that leads to such radical misunderstandings of the research. You know, we're talking about journalists and scientists here. Journalists themselves are taught a very different methodology of inquiry than scientists. So their attempts to report on science stories often require them to post hoc fit the conclusions of science into their news narrative. They're taught, you know, the who, what, where, when, why, and how. But that's not really how science works. They're trying to say, here's the conclusion of the scientific research and here's what it means. But that's often not the point of the research. So,
and often something that the scientists would love to say themselves but can't because the data doesn't support it.
Exactly. And I think in terms of the general public, there's an ignorance of critical inquiry. So people don't understand the methodology that you go through in science to understand a given phenomenon. People want these sort of clear, cut, direct, black and white answers to questions. And nuance and the sort of skepticism that you need in science is just misunderstood, distrusted, ignored, and thought as worthless. So in the case of neurology, people want to understand why people do things that they do. That's obviously a huge motivating factor, but they don't want a complicated answer. They want something clear and simple. They want people to say, the reason somebody does this is because there's a chemical in their brain. Oh, a chemical in your brain. Well, can I eat carrots that make this chemical go away? Yes, eat carrots.
Or nasal spray?
Or perhaps. Nasal spray, or anything. It's we've seen this so many times where some study will come out and say, there's a 0.2% chance that coffee is going to reduce your cancer risk. Oh my God, drink all the coffee I have. And people change their lives, and they stop drinking coffee, or they only drink coffee, or they stop eating carrots, or they only eat... And it's... They don't understand what the probability factors are here. They don't understand the methodology. They don't understand the peer review process. And this is because people just don't have a concrete knowledge of how science works.
But why don't they?
Well, this is one of the major problems, and we've been talking about sort of two of the factors in here. We have the scientists who are sort of, we'll call them sort of the primary knowledge dispersal people, because they're the ones getting it. And then you have your intermediaries being the media, but what about the consumers? As Ethan was pointing up, we have a public knowledge deficit that also needs to be addressed. And although we've been talking about some neurology-specific research, there's obviously this kind of problem in any sort of scientific area. So the second question they asked is really what types of damage are done when science is reported poorly, or let's say communicated poorly, because then that's going to put an emphasis on everybody, the scientists, the press, and the audience. So the Cardiff scientists behind the Guardian article posit that there are basically three things that can happen if science is completely misreported in the press. So firstly, people have the option to not believe the article, and to do so because they don't trust the reporting. So that is, they're skeptical of the article because they think the press got the science wrong. According to one scientist, me, this is the correct response. So, you know, you see something that's really sensational, you say, I wonder if that's true. But you don't say, that scientist is a crackpot. You say, I wonder, you know, if something got lost in translation. So... Unfortunately, according to the scientists in this article, they analyzed the comments and the blogging that was happening based on the newspaper articles, ostensibly based on the research, and they found that really this was almost never coming up. So most people didn't read it and say the press got it wrong, but rather responded in one of the other two ways. So a second way that people can respond is, obviously, by just believing the story and then possibly spreading it. So this is how stories of the riot-curing nasal sprays made it all the way around the globe. And obviously this causes harm to the public, depending on the severity of the mistake, because we want to have the right information. So I think everyone can pretty much think of their own examples where having the wrong information is a bad thing. So the third response is possibly the most dangerous. And this is when, again, you don't believe the article, but it's not because of the reporting, it's because you don't believe the science. And unfortunately, according to this article, again, this is a really common response. And this type of reaction is, why are the scientists wasting public money on this? And they always say that they're going to cure something. They're always reporting cures, but then it never comes to, you know, never comes to be. Or, like I was saying, this scientist is a crackpot, and this is bull. So when this happens, inaccurate reporting breaks down the confidence the public has in scientists. Because if you're reading an article, have no reason to mistrust the reporting and therefore mistrust the scientists, your general confidence in science and the conclusions it's drawn from this process is decreased. And this is incredibly important and really damaging. So the reason that we have scientists and do spend public money on scientific research is to provide vital and dependable knowledge that's, you know, evidence-based for public safety, etc. So it's when the trust in science breaks down that people stop believing scientists, when they tell people about the really important things like realities of climate change, or that you should really, really, really vaccinate with your kids with the MMR vaccine, or other scientific consensus that people decide as a community not to buy.
But see, I think here now we're getting into maybe a deeper culprit here. Because, I mean, so far we've been sort of having the scientists on one side and journalists on the other. But in some of these examples, I think it's more appropriate to look at things like corporations or religion. I mean, it has been the goal of at least some industries to cast doubt on science, be it tobacco and cancer or coal and climate change, by sort of creating a systemic feeling of doubt that science is somehow not real, or worse, that it's simply a form of job security for intellectual elites. That this is what's sort of partly driving this sort of cycle of doubt. I mean, the same mentality comes in with religion. I mean, if you accept that science is, quote, real, then you have to start accepting that your beliefs don't match up with reality, and that creates a cognitive dissonance in your brain. But whereas if you sort of look at science as sort of a social choice that can be accepted, like some stylings of clothing or whatever, then this allows you much more malleability, but it also allows you to actively misinterpret science, to say scientists, well, they say what they believe, but it's not really true because I somehow have special access to it. I mean, this leads deeply to not only a metaphysical distrust of science, but an actual hostility and anti-science movement that you see so many times out there.
Well, and I think what Ethan was saying about us needing to really foster scientific understanding of the basic stuff and just like the basic methodology and hypothesis testing and the difference between causation and correlation and those type of concepts is really important in all levels of the scientific communication process. And I know we're running short on time here, so maybe I'll address this in a segment in the future or maybe in a blog post. But yeah, I really believe that as far as when we're going to address the how, for how are we going to fix this mess, it really has to be engagement of all levels and working on integrating a more fundamental understanding of science that will engender trust.
Well, see, I think this problem is bigger than a journalist-scientist miscommunication problem. I think that this problem ultimately relates to news media is a schizophrenic animal, and that it has two goals. It has one goal to present the facts of the world in an honest, neutral way for the empowerment of the people. And then it also has this other goal to make money. And you can't be honest, neutral, and make money. Ask NPR. They tried it, didn't work. The problem is that in order to stay in business, you need the sensational headlines. And science can't give you sensational headlines like, you know, scientists discover 0.5% increase of cancer risk from drinking coffee. It's not that sensational. It's much better to say, coffee causes cancer. You will all die tomorrow, or something. And, you know, this is unfortunately sort of a fact of the way science works. So, you know, journalists are in a position where they need to make a marketable project or product. And science is not going to give them a marketable product unless we cure cancer or cold fusion is discovered or something.
And I posit that we can't make a marketable product to the current audience. But like I was saying, if there is a more widespread understanding of the way that science works and those little wee plodding steps and how exciting those really can be in the general public, I think the headlines could look different and still sell papers.
Well, I agree, but I don't think that's going to happen through science journalist relations. I think the only way that's going to happen is you start with the average person, and when you're educating them, you educate them on science, the basic principles of science, but you also have to educate them on why science is important. I mean, Carl Sagan was big on saying that we are heading towards a catastrophe because 90% of the people in the world don't know how half of the applications in their very own kitchen work, their microwave, their fridge. They don't know. It could be magic for all they care. And that's something that I think is very true, and that until we start teaching people to appreciate and want to learn about science, we're not going to see a change. And if we do, perhaps we'll have this sort of trickle-up effect where journalists will have the basic science skills needed to understand a study and say how to report it effectively.
Actually, I first of all, I agree totally that we need better education for the populace in general, and that's one of the things. But I would go even further, and I mean, it's this whole business of the press. I mean, the fact that journalists themselves who are doing science news are becoming less and less educated in science, not because that they're stupid people, but because who needs a science department when the guy who does the weekend weather, he's got an hour free, he can do a little report on this. So you're getting people who are literally not qualified for the job because it's part of budget-cutting measures. You also get, you know, because they're reducing staff, journalists themselves start getting more and more work that they have to do, so they have less time to spend on any one story, which, again, not only creates opportunities for distortions thanks to ignorance, but literally they have to come up with a shorthand of things. They can't afford to have three paragraphs to explain the details of this particular research or what the implications are. They got to do it in one line, and they got to make it catchy, because as Ethan sort of pointed out, that, I mean, for-profit corporations, they're global, they're internet connected, they're 24/7, and they've got to spike the stories with over-the-top headlines, mind-hook, catchy sort of first paragraphs that are supposed to tell you everything but don't tell you anything, right? I mean, it's not the journalists maybe themselves, it's not the scientists in itself, it's the fact that we sort of have this institution of private, for-profit journalism that creates this environment in the first place where the facts don't matter as long as it sells the papers.
Mm-hmm. And I do think that the sort of profitability thing is a major issue that sort of, I think, probably stretches beyond just scientific communication into general reporting. I'm sure that there are a lot of social issues that have a detriment from that as well. But as far as scientific specifically, I think we're all on the same track that it's sort of about everybody having the right tools to communicate and the right tools to interpret what you're hearing and be able to interpret that in a reasonable way.
Right. Well, I mean, this is a huge topic and we just can't possibly go through it all. So hopefully I look forward to reading a very detailed blog post, Jenna. Let's go to our skeptical highlights, though.
I got one here. I had two, but I'll save one for next week. The Climate Reality Project, starting on Wednesday, Al Gore will launch the 24 Hours of Reality as part of the Climate Reality Project. It will expound on climate change for 24 hours straight. The organization will also commandeer social media accounts of willing participants throughout the event in order to make this a truly global media event to address the global threat. The presentation will feature 200 new slides arguing the connection between more extreme weather and climate change. Will these change climate deniers' minds? Probably not. But it will help refresh the sane majority out there of the realities of climate change and the dangers that it will cause. When is this going on? Wednesday, 7 p.m. local time in every time zone on the planet. So at every time zone, when it hits 7 p.m., they have one speaker who's going to talk for an hour about a particular topic to expand upon the risks and dangers of climate change. You can find out more about this at Climate Reality Project, all one word, .org on the interweb.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about when people decide to take science home. So there's a quantified self and the N equals one movement. So this is a little offbeat for me, as I usually like to go for larger sample sizes than one being a scientist. But this is sort of an interesting website, and it's called Quantified Self and Exploring Various People's Attempt at Self-Experimentation. No, nothing particularly gory, and their results. So I leave it open to all of you for skeptical interpretation and exploration, and it's at quantifiedself.com.
And my skeptical highlight is Reasonable Women, a CFI Vancouver-sponsored women's-only skeptical group, or for those self-identifying as a woman. Respectable Women hopes to provide an opportunity for the secular women of Vancouver to gather together to talk about what it's like to be a godless woman in the world today, in addition to being a female voice in the new atheist movement. This is happening Sunday, September 25th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Kitsun Housing Cooperative Meeting Room at 2431 Vine Street in Vancouver. Well, we're out of time here on the show, so this is Ethan saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Jenna saying remember, the real world is amazing.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com.
and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.